picture an airplane coming back from its 200th mission. Not 200 missions for the squadron, 200 for one airframe. The same aluminum skin, riveted and patched until the repairs nearly outnumbered the original panels. When the crew chiefs finally sat down and counted all the patches on this particular airplane, the number came out somewhere around 1,000. 1,000 holes, tears, punctures, and shrapnel wounds. 1,000 times the enemy tried to bring it down, and 1,000 times it kept flying. The airplane's name was Flak Bait, and if there is a better argument for why warbird restoration matters, I have not heard it. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we are talking about one of the most important warbird preservation projects currently underway in America. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. To understand why Flak Bait matters, you have to understand the airplane it flew in. The Martin B-26 Marauder did not have an easy beginning. The Glenn L. Martin Company designed it to an Army specification that valued speed above almost everything else. What they produced was a medium bomber with serious horsepower. Two Pratt & Whitney R2800 engines, each putting out close to 2,000 horsepower, a cruise speed around 250 miles per hour, which made it one of the fastest medium bombers of the early war years. A maximum speed pushing 300 miles per hour at altitude. But the performance came at a cost. The wing was short, very short relative to the weight of the aircraft. The wing loading was among the highest of any combat airplane being built in quantity at the time. What that meant in practical terms was this: the B-26 had no patience for slow flight. The approach speed was high. The stall was sharp and unforgiving. If you got behind the power curve, you were in serious trouble and you did not have much altitude or time to fix it. When the training command started putting students through B-26 transition at bases in Florida and Texas, the accident rate climbed. Then it climbed some more. Pilots, who were accustomed to more forgiving trainers and earlier combat types, found that the Marauder demanded everything they had. It would not tolerate a flat approach or a pilot who was mentally behind the airplane. The machine wanted speed, and if you did not give it speed, it quit flying. The crews gave it a nickname, the Widowmaker. Some called it the Flying Prostitute because the wings were so short, there was no visible means of support. Dark humor is what combat aviators use when they are genuinely afraid of something, and some of those pilots were genuinely afraid of this airplane. Things got serious enough that there were congressional hearings. Voices in Washington called for canceling the B-26 program entirely, or at minimum grounding the fleet while the accident rate was investigated. The future of the Marauder was genuinely in question. What saved it was a demonstration. Brigadier General James Doolittle went to the training bases and flew the B-26. Repeatedly, he took it through every maneuver. He showed instructors the right approach speeds, the proper power management, the right way to handle a go-around. His message was that this airplane was not a death trap. It was a demanding airplane, one that required discipline and proper technique. Fly it correctly and it would perform. Fly it sloppy and it would punish you for it. After that intervention, training methods improved and the accident rate came down. And then the crews who had trained on the Marauder started taking it to war and everything changed. What had seemed like a flaw in peacetime, that uncompromising performance envelope, turned out to be an asset in combat. The B-26 was fast, it hit hard, and if you knew what you were doing, you could push it through conditions that would have stopped a slower airplane cold. The 322nd Bomb Group was one of the first B-26 units sent to England. On the 14th of May 1943, the group flew its first combat mission. It was a low-level strike against a power station at IJmuiden in the Netherlands. It did not go well. The Germans were waiting. The anti-aircraft defenses were devastating at low altitude, and the attacking formation took brutal losses. It was one of the worst days the B-26 community had in the entire war. Command looked hard at low-level tactics after that, and the group switched to medium-altitude bombing in the 10,000 to 15,000-foot range, where the accuracy was still good and the flak exposure was more manageable. One of the airplanes that flew on May 14, 1943, was a brand new B-26 Marauder assigned to the 449th Bomb Squadron. Serial number 41, 31773. It had just arrived with the group. This was its first combat mission. It survived, then it flew again. And again, and again, and again. The airplane picked up a name from the ground crews who repaired it after every mission. They called it Flak Bait. The name fit over the next 2 years. Flak Bait flew from England and later from France as the Allied armies pushed east across the continent. The targets changed as the campaign evolved. Rail yards and marshalling yards to strangle German logistics. bridges over the Seine and the Rhine to slow the movement of reinforcements, fuel storage depots, V-weapon launch sites along the Channel coast, airfields. The B-26 was a precision weapon at the tactical level, and there was always a target list longer than there were airplanes to fly it. Every mission carried risk. The Germans were experienced at defending the targets that Allied bombers attacked, and they concentrated their best anti-aircraft units around the most critical installations. The flak over a defended rail yard or river crossing could fill the sky with black bursts, and a medium bomber flying straight and level on a bombing run was exactly the kind of target the German gun crews had trained all their careers to engage. The crews flew through it because the mission required it, because the accuracy of the bomb drop depended on holding course even when every instinct was screaming to jink and evade. Flak bait took hits. It came back with holes in the fuselage, in the wings and the tail surfaces. The ground crews repaired what they could, patched what they could not fully repair, and had the airplane ready to fly again. Some of those hits were close to fatal. Some of them killed crew members. On one mission, a gunner, on another, the navigator. The men who flew with flak bait rotated through, completing their tours and going home. The airplane outlasted them. It flew on. One pilot became particularly associated with flak bait. Lieutenant James Patillo, known to his crewmates as Pug, flew many of the airplane's missions and developed the kind of relationship with a specific airframe that combat aviators talk about in hushed tones. After you have survived that many missions in the same airplane, something happens. The airplane becomes yours in a way that is hard to explain to someone who has not flown in combat. You know its tendencies. The way it handles with a full bomb load versus a light one. The particular sound of those two engines at cruise. The way the controls feel in turbulence. You have a history with it. And flak bait had more history than almost any other airplane in the theater. By the time Germany surrendered in May of 1945, flak bait had completed 207 combat missions. That is the record for any American aircraft in the entire Second World War, by a significant margin. 207 exposures to enemy fire, to weather, to mechanical failure, to everything the war could put in front of a medium bomber operating deep into defended territory. Think about what that number means. Most bombers lasted a fraction of that operational life. Crews rotated home after 25 missions, then 50, as the tour length requirements evolved over the course of the war. Airframes were lost to combat damage, to accidents, to the simple attrition of heavy operational use. Flak bait kept coming back. The patches multiplied until the aluminum skin of the airplane was more repair than original panel in some sections. The ground crews who worked on it had become specialists in this one airplane. They knew where the problem areas were. They knew what to check first when it came back with new holes. In a real sense, they had a partnership with a machine. After Germany surrendered, flak bait was flown to England for disposition. Someone at the Smithsonian Institution recognized what they had. This was not just surplus military equipment to be scrapped or sold off. This was the most flown combat aircraft in American history, and it wore its history on its skin. Those 1,000 patches were not damaged to be corrected or hidden. They were the record. The Smithsonian took flak bait. For decades, the nose section was displayed at the National Air and Space Museum on the National Mall in Washington. Visitors could see the cockpit, the nose art, the mission markers, but the rest of the airplane, the fuselage, the wings, the empennage, went into storage. Over the years, the conditions were not always ideal for long-term preservation of aluminum and fabric. Corrosion worked its way in, the fabric control surfaces degraded. Rubber components hardened and cracked. Plexiglass that had once been clear went cloudy and brittle. By the time the Smithsonian made a formal commitment to restore and display the complete airplane, around 2012, they had real work ahead of them. The restoration is being done at the Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. One of the things that makes Udvar Hazy different from a lot of aviation museums is that their preservation work happens in a facility where visitors can watch through a glass wall. Any day. The center is open. You can walk up to that observation window and see what the conservators and volunteers are working on. It is not theater. It is real work happening in real time, on a real artifact. Now here's where it gets interesting, from a restoration philosophy standpoint. The Smithsonian is not trying to make flak bait look new. They are not filling those patches, smoothing the skin, and putting a fresh coat of paint over 70 years of hard use. That is not how museum conservation works, and it would be deeply wrong for this particular airplane. It would be erasure. The goal is stabilization and preservation. Treat the corrosion so it stops progressing. Document every repair, every patch, every field modification. Understand what is original factory material and what was repaired at a forward air base somewhere in England or France. Stabilize the structures that need it. Reconstruct the fabric surfaces that are beyond saving. using period-accurate materials and methods so the airplane can be safely displayed and will survive another generation in a controlled museum environment. Those patches stay. They have to stay. Each one of those patches is a primary historical document. It tells you that on some specific mission, on some specific day over a defended target, a piece of flak or an anti-aircraft round came through the skin of this airplane at that precise location. A ground crew repaired it using the materials and techniques they had available in the field. The airplane flew again. To fill or hide that evidence would be to destroy what makes this artifact irreplaceable. It would turn a witness into a replica. The restoration team has done archival research alongside the physical work. Veterans of the 322nd Bomb Group and the 449th Bomb Squadron, in the early years of the project, some of them were still able to contribute their recollections and their photographs. Their accounts of what specific components looked like, how systems were maintained in the field, what was done to keep one particular airplane flying mission after mission, that information is now part of the permanent documentary record. As those veterans have passed, the documentation they contributed has become more valuable, not less. Skilled volunteers work alongside the professional conservators, retired engineers, metalworkers, aviation historians, people who have spent decades working on vintage aluminum aircraft. They bring knowledge that is genuinely hard to find and harder to replace. And there is a preservation happening at the human level too, not just the physical one. The techniques, the understanding of wartime construction methods and field repair practices, the hands-on knowledge that flows from an experienced conservator to a skilled volunteer and then onward, that is also something the museum is saving. This kind of work takes years. That is the nature of doing it right. A conservation team does not rush corrosion treatment, does not shortcut the documentation process, does not substitute a close enough part when the research says exactly what was installed. They measure twice and they cut once and they document everything before they touch it. When the complete restoration of flak bait is finished, visitors to Udvar-Hazy will be able to walk around the entire airplane. They will see a medium bomber that looks like it has been to war because it has not polished to factory standard, not restored in a way that removes the evidence. Honest. And if the museum does its job with the interpretive material, the people who stand in front of it will understand what they are looking at. 207 missions, 1,000 patches, the men who flew it, the men who fixed it, the men who never came home from it. All of that is in the metal if you know how to read it. That is what a restoration can do when it is done right. Not just preserve an airplane, preserve a story. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum documents the Flak Bay project on their website, and you can visit the Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia, to see the work in progress yourself. Historical detail in today's segment draws from the museum's own project documentation and records of the 322nd Bomb Group. More episodes of The Hangar are at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Some stories you don't need to dress up, you just tell them straight and let the metal speak for itself.